Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
And welcome again to another episode of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I am your guest host, Katie Langston, but do not fret, our good friend Dan is here. He's just here as a panelist today. We're very excited to have a super fun and useful and interesting topic. We're going to be discussing Fowler and the stages of faith and faith development and how this can help us or influence us as we are perhaps going through a faith transition or feel ourselves doubting in a pretty serious way, or are perhaps in a place where we're wanting to reconstruct our faith or maybe come through an acute or painful period of faith transition. Just kind of discuss some models for how and why this happens and maybe get in a little bit to how this information can be of use to us on our spiritual journey. So I am very excited to be the guest host today. And we'd love to introduce our wonderful panelists. First, we have Dan, whom you all know very, very well. Dan Witherspoon is the host of Mormon Matters. And Dan, in the customary Mormon Matters fashion, why don't you tell us a little about yourself?
That's fun. Thanks so much for doing this, Katie. I know that Stages of Faith and this model has been something cool that you've interacted with, so I appreciate you taking the lead here. I had asked to be a panelist just for everybody as information, just as a way to kind of feel a little bit less in that precarious position of hoping that everyone will, you know, cover the material that I want them to cover, you know, as the host. And so I've been lecturing at UVU and just kind of to Mormon groups a lot lately about stages of faith. And so I kind of have a little presentation, and I just wanted to have that freedom to push it out there. One other quick note is John DeLynn, back in 2006, one of the very first podcasts he did with Mormon Stories was with Tom Kimball and I on the Stages of Faith. And Tom is a friend of mine who for a long time he and I had been discussing Stages of Faith, and it was an important thing in his life. And so we did kind of a quick overview introduction there, and lots of people. I mean, that's the one that I still almost hear from people a few times a year, but early on it was just all the time of, wow, that was an important podcast to me. And since then, on Mormon Matters, we've talked about Fowler, we've talked about Stages of Faith, but we've never really fully presented it, so I just wanted for this audience to have a fresh dive with it. But my basic background is, born, raised within the church, fell into some different things when I was younger that led me to kind of lose sort of the spirit, or I don't know if that, I don't like that language because I've rechanged it myself, but I kind of just fell away from the things that I thought that I had incorporated deeply into my soul. But it was pretty easy to start falling into partying and whatnot. I had some epiphanies and things that happened and some help when I was 20, in my early 20s. And came back to faith and had some experiences. Eventually went on a mission, eventually studied religion at, BA in philosophy from BYU, an MA in religious studies from Arizona State, and a PhD in religion from Claremont. And it was during this process, and maybe I'll share a little bit more later, that Stages of Faith was introduced to me. But it was only like later, it was only just late 90s that it really started to be this powerful framing that helped me so much in my journey to find a lot of peace and to kind of find like I was on a path that I think, you know, life almost calls us to. So I'll just stop at that.
Thank you, Dan. That was great. And then joining us also is Mary Beth Rain. And Mary Beth is a clinical social worker, marriage therapist in private practice in Salt Lake. And why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself as well, Mary Beth?
Thank you. It's good to join you. I came across developmental stages in undergraduate and graduate school in the 1960s. I have a master's degree also in marriage and family sociology, essentially. And there's a lot of emphasis on human developmental stages and then even the developmental stages of families, marriages and families. And so that was a background template that sort of went by the by in terms of just my main focal point after I started graduate school in social work and then graduated in like 1979, became a therapist. And then in the early 1980s, I came across Ken Wilber, who probably the two of you know, and just started reading him over and over again. And so it became sort of, again, a way to add to the template I'd had before about developmental stages. And so by the early 1990s, I had sort of developed a working knowledge of it. And I'll tell you what happened. And that is, essentially, I've been very interested in maps most of my life. I grew up on the Oregon coast, but my mother lived in Provo. And so we would travel back and forth, and I would read the maps all the time, and my dad would help me with the maps. And so essentially, these maps of Wilber, of other theorists, and of Fowler are sort of like a spiritual Google Earth.
Nice.
And so it became very important to me in my practice so that I could kind of not only know where I was at the time, sort of, you know, where I could position myself on the map and where I would jump back and forth between stages depending on what was happening, but I could hear it in clients. And so I'll go more into that later, but essentially it became really important. Along that, and again, reread Fowler in the last, you know, little while, is that I followed, my stage of development followed pretty much along Fowler's line about the same ages in which he outlines it, which is very interesting. This seems to be an organic unfolding. So about me, it became this map process that I could really use in terms of developmental stages. In terms of my own life, I grew up Mormon, a little tiny town on the coast of Oregon, and we belonged to a very conservative family where we were really at the mythic literal stage, I would say. And I had no connection to Mormon culture really because it was just a small branch of 15 to 30 people. So I came to BYU. I had this amazing intellectual opening, but didn't start really moving to the next level until sort of much later. And I had a full-blown crisis of faith, I would say, from probably 1977 through the 80s. It took me about 15 years to really work with material and try to make sense of it. And so it's been a long journey. I have been at times, most of the time active, but then several years not any connection or any activity. But I am now active, again, in the church, and I don't go all the time, and I'm pretty heterodox, but I certainly can come back and call it home again. It's like being in your homeland and then living abroad for many years and then returning. So that's me.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that introduction. I think what we're going to do is we're going to start out and maybe talk a little bit about our own stories with Fowler's book or Faith Development. And I think both of you shared a little bit about that. But is there anything else, we can start with Dan, that you want to add to sort of flesh out that story of your own experience and, you know, how you were really introduced to the model and, you know, when you discovered that it was helpful?
Yeah, I do want to tell a piece of it because it's an interesting, I had two introductions to it 9 years apart, and the first time it didn't really strike me, the second time it was like a lifesaver. And so basically what happened is in 1988, I began my master's program in religious studies at Arizona State, and one of the classes that you'll often take in a graduate program is what they call a methods class. In other words, it's kind of an overview or a map of the territory in terms of here's the field, here's the different possibilities, here's the different ways of approaching it. And so this methods class was an introduction to anthropological approaches to religion, sociological approaches to religion, feminist critique, you know, gender critique of religion. We learned the history of religion methodology that kind of emerged through, you know, the University of Chicago. Well, when it came to psychology and religion, Fowler's book, Stages of Faith, was one of the ones that was presented. And it was presented as, you know, basically you do a book a week, you know, in these classes. It's a, you know, 3 or 4 hour seminar, but you always have to read a book a week. And I read through it and I thought it was mildly interesting, but at the time, you know, I you know, kind of had my reimmersion back in Mormonism, and I was only at grad school to kind of get some fine tuning on, you know, I obviously knew the truth already. I was so confident in my worldview that hardly anything in that first semester or so was getting through to my core spiritual level. And so when I read Stages of Faith, and as we talk about stages 3, 4, and 5, you know, in my own brain, I'm kind of like stage 5 kind of guy, you know, because I obviously had had my periods of doubt and struggle and things like this. And so it just didn't really strike me. But yet I remember my fellow grad students in the seminar were just like totally taking this. And so anyway, so just know that it kind of came and went in my consciousness because I wasn't really, quote unquote, in need of it, because I didn't really map myself in it in any kind of existential angst, you know, feeding that. Well, right. Then the most interesting thing happened, and it's just, you know, I wrote a piece on it in Sunstone. I can't remember what I called it, but it's just like, by some strange coincidence, in November 1997, I decided to, you know, I went to the American Academy of Religion meeting. It was in San Francisco that year. Delta has a hub in Salt Lake City, and Atlanta is another hub. And I ended up being in the same row with James Fowler and my seat. And so 20 minutes into the flight or something, and there was an empty seat between us, I noticed that he was reading some kind of, you know, religious studies book, and I was too, you know, and I just reached out and I said, I wonder if we're going to the same conference. And we had this really wonderful, you know, hello, yes, my name is James Fowler. I go, oh, I know your name. And I'm starting to rack in my brain. What do I know it from? And he let me off the hook really fast. He kind of goes, oh, I know what I called my essay. It was called When I Needed It Most. So whether it's the universe doing it or not, but, you know, he kind of came along at the exact time that I needed him. And he goes, well, you know, whatever kind of, you know, name recognition it has, it's usually according to my book, Stages of Faith. And we talk, and I go, oh, yes, of course, I read that. And I kind of, you know, tried to find some superlative to talk about it, because you want to always tell an author how much you loved it. But he kind of let me off the hook because I was just hemming and hawing a little bit. And we just moved on. And soon he was asking me about if I'd ever heard of Sunstone, because he had spoken at Sunstone before. And it just turned out to be this great conversation. And he told me about his new book that was just coming out right then called Faithful Change. And so I grabbed it the second that I got to the conference from the big book sales thing. And I carried it around with me all the time, hoping that I'd bump into him in this big convention center again, get him to sign it or whatever. I didn't, but I read that book. And by the time I was, you know, home from that conference, I just like, let me get my Stages of Faith out. And I reread it. And because I was coming from the other side of this, what we're going to call stage 4, what he maps out as stage 4, this book was just like Mary Beth sort of said, you could just see your own life, you know, described here in this map. And it was just so powerful for me. And it gave me a lot of hope, a lot of, anyway, it was a nice, like I say, a map that just sort of said, this is what's been going on with me, and guess what? It's a good journey. So anyway, I'll stop with that. But that's how I kind of got into it, and it just became so important to me.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mary Beth, is there anything you want to add or that you would add about your own experience? And, you know, when you talk about the map, tell us a little bit more about, you know, how you found that and why you find that useful, and anything else you want to, you know, you want to throw out here at the beginning about your own journey with regards to faith development and stages and so on.
Yes, I would say that if I look at Fowler stages, that I clearly, at the time I first encountered developmental theory, was still at the mythic literal. However, at that time in the 1960s, Fowler wasn't around yet. We were, you know, looking at other developmental stage maps. So when I started through this crisis of faith, I would say in 1977, when I was looking at the, you know, the new Mormon history, starting to go to Sunstone and just going through full blown, if this is not all literally true, then, you know, how do I hang out in the void?
Which was very,
this was a sort of very chaotic time, and I would have loved to have that map at that time, because it would have oriented me that what I was going through was entirely normal and it wasn't an end stage. So when I ran onto Wilbur in the 80s, it kind of just opened up a door. I soaked it all up. It was an early article before the other books, around the time the other books, in which he gave his spiritual and intellectual autobiography. of how we came into what he went into. And then I felt like I could orient to something I could grasp on and realize, oh, there is solid ground here, but it's very different ground than what I previously saw as solid ground. And that helped anchor me. Then later I came to Fowler. He actually has come to Sunstone a couple times, I would say.
Right. Yeah, I invited him once I became the editor.
Yeah. So came on to Fowler, and that helped patch it in. So it's like creating a map. You remember how the old medieval maps and then on our maps now, we keep adding in pieces until they become more and more rich and detailed so that we can relate to where we're actually going on that territory, even if it's into the hinterlands. And so it helped anchor me emotionally because I had been so deeply attached to the church. And not just that, but the spiritual connection to God has been the core process for me. Given I didn't grow up in Mormon culture, that cultural reference has not been as important to me. It's been, what is the inner experience? Even though clearly what happened in the outer experience and going to church and living in commands and so on were all really important. So it became a kind of an anchor, a place where I could then start to move forward, even though it was still somewhat chaotic and I didn't know exactly where to land. The other piece that is added into it, so keep in mind I've had a sort of this double life with Fowler and other developmental stages. One is my own, and the other is being a therapist. So that I was trained finished in 1979, and then started moving into private practice after working in agency in 1981, finally in private practice 86. And so I started to notice it was very helpful for me to assess the developmental level of the people I was working with, quite apart from the other assessments that we were doing. And what I noticed fairly early on is that when people have a lot of inner conflicts or conflicts with their outer world, often it's two different or three different stages operating or floating around at once. And so it became, I'll change analogies, it became like a Rosetta Stone. Because then I could go back to Wilbur, other developmental theories, Fowler, and say, okay, where's this literally, and where is the conflict? Where's somebody stuck that they've had in Wilbur's experience? P-E-E-K experience of a P-E-A-K experience, which jumps them like going in an elevator to two or three stages ahead, but they have no way to stabilize it in their life, no way to integrate it other than it's this amazing thing, and then it feels disjointed, and I experienced the same thing. I would have these P-E-A-K experiences again and again and have them my whole life spiritually, but I didn't have a way to live it. I wasn't there in my modal or in my center of gravity balance, and so things kind of jump back and forth a lot. So for me, it's been helpful to feel like, okay, even though it's jumping back and forth, and even though I feel, you know, kind of I can get triggered by upsetting events or traumatic events, clearly, it gave me a handrail, so to speak, or someplace or to hold on and then come back to again and again and again. So it starts there, much like a map or Google Map. It's in my brain all the time. It's there as a framework, almost like I can see the rubric of Fowler and Wilbur's and other stages in the background, and I can pull from and back and forth. And so it's an orienting map for me at this point. That doesn't mean my life has been just, you know, easy across the stages. In fact, if you read Fowler,
you have to live in the territory, not just have a map of it.
You have to live in the territory. Yeah, it's in some ways, yeah, it's some like somebody's going down a river and they encounter rapids, and then if there's somebody on the bank watching and guiding or observing, it helps that person navigate the rapids, but they still have to navigate the rapids. They still have to go in the twists and turns of the river, and that's how I experience Fowler and Wilbur and other people. So it's been enormously calming, even while the rapids are there. So I would say that's, even though I'm being abstract at the moment, that has had such an enormous anchoring and orienting effect in my life.
Yeah, no, I can definitely, I resonate with what you're saying. And I can definitely say, like, in my own experience, just knowing that this is a place where other people have been and that this is sort of a natural part of development and spiritual development and so on is profoundly useful. And to know that there's another level, that there's something beyond the current pain and confusion and, you know, world and chaos that I'm experiencing, just knowing that is is very comforting, even while you're, as you were saying, Mary Beth, even while you're in the middle of the rapids, when you're in the middle of the most difficult part. When we did that Navigating the Borderlands presentation or conference at Sunstone, and I was the first person to speak, and my job was kind of to orient people in that, you know, orient people in the meeting, but then also give them a sense of normalizing the fact that faith transitions happen. And in our culture, there's not a lot of that. It's sort of seen as really scary or dangerous or negative, or, you know, it has a lot of relational fallout. Mm-hmm. And so my, you know, what I really wanted to get across to people, because it had been so helpful to me, was this idea of, you know, even though our culture doesn't know what to do with it, you know, and maybe some of the people around us don't know what to do with it, this is actually a really positive thing. This is actually something that, you know, that means that we're growing. It's something that means that we're really wrestling with, you know, important questions and learning more about ourselves and, you know, deconstructing what's important to us and giving ourselves the authority in our lives to approach truth and approach life on our own terms. And that this is, you know, this is healthy, this is good. So just being able to shift it from something's wrong with me, something's wrong with me, something's wrong with me, I'm in pain, I'm hurting, I'm confused, you know, I don't have faith, I'm, you know, I'm losing so much. Be able to shift that and say, no, actually, like, you know, this is positive, this is growth. I'm gaining experience, I'm gaining, you know, self-worth and self-respect. That, you know, is something that's very, very useful to me on my journey as well. So
let me share another developmental model just briefly, but it matches everything else. And it's just a quick little analogy or statement. Years ago, I heard Lavina Anderson say, you know, we're all taught that we are children of God. But as we continue to grow spiritually, we think about things and we, you know, we kick against the pricks, or we're really, you know, confused and whatever. We become adolescents of God. But in the long run, what God really wants are adults of God.
Nice.
And I think that matches different stages of Fowler. By the way, I would encourage people who are listening to this, if they can, and if they have Fowler available, to stop the conversation, go open up the book where you get a sense of all of the stages, or make some sense of it, and kind of tape it up somewhere so it makes sense, because I realize the three of us are talking from a common knowledge, but if somebody's just listening to this without knowing what those stages are, it gets really confusing.
You can also find it on Wikipedia, which I may or may not have quoted as my source in my talk.
Oh, that's good. That's even better, right?
Well, you can, but it's such dense. I mean, the book is actually, I want to warn people, I mean, this is an academic book in some ways. I mean, he peppers it all the way throughout with people's experiences. Basically, what he and his team did was interview, I believe it was close to 700 people. No, 400 people, 360 people, 180 men, 179 women, I just noticed on my notes. And so he has their personal experience, but it's thick and it's dense. And so when I look at the Wikipedia, or when I look at just these, you know, one paragraph descriptions of the stages, they help, but they are also such thickly worded stuff. I don't think people get a sense. But then it was interesting, as I was just going through the book the last couple of days again, to notice that even the descriptions of the stages are only like 10 pages long, 10 to 12 pages long in the book. And so, but they're rich, but there's still some density. So I think it's important to have discussions like this too, where, and especially to have Mary Beth here, who can kind of talk about what that looks like in therapy, or what it looks like when she can see that people are stuck or whatever. And I just loved, I'll tell you what I loved almost what you said more than anything else in your introduction, Mary Beth, is that you said you were transitioning for like 15 years. Right?
Oh, so, yes.
Yeah.
And Fowler talks about this, that many people will take, within moving from a stage to a stage, it will take many, 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 many years. It is more chaotic at first and so on. But that's overall developmental theory. So developmental theory isn't just about stages. Developmental theory is how we move from stage to stage,
right,
which in my Sunstone article of November 2001 about sex and spirit explains that there are many developmental processes. And one of them is if you're coming along with the normal kind of route, it's, you know, once you're reaching adulthood, it's 7 to 10 stages to keep going. And that's chaotic at first, and then we consolidate it over time before we move on to the next stage. So it's a kind of a disruption, chaotic, trying to make sense of a new world view, and then you consolidate it over time until you master it, and then you almost evolutionary, like it unfolds within you. Sometimes there are trigger events, and people then notice that and say, oh, well, this caused it. Actually, you were ready for that stage of development, and then the event or events kindled it and or triggered it so that you then move through. And it's much like you watch a child to move from stage to stage. You watch it unfold, and we are kind of see that as magical and interesting, and we expect it. We just don't have maps for adult development. We do, by the way, but they're all academic, as in Fowler. So it's kind of hard to traverse that territory. Anyway.
Yes, awesome. And, you know, your thing about he wants, you know, children, adolescents, spiritual adults. Phil McLemore, I've mentioned it a time or two in my podcast, but he has a model that are five things within the scriptures, that there's a parent-child relationship. The gospel also calls us to the master-steward relationship, where there's the master to the vineyard and we're stewards who work and build the kingdom. But then the next stage is the most interesting one in some ways, which is the disciple stage. And if you, it's especially easy to see it in Eastern traditions when you, you know, let's say I'm entering into a monastery and I'm a learner, you know, or I guess we can go to Star Wars, the Padawan learner, you know, with Yoda or something. The idea is, though, that you practice disciplines, and that's where the heart of the word disciple, so that you can someday become the master yourself. And you know, eventually, and I recognize this in my own PhD program and things like this, you know, clearly these professors were my teachers. But at a certain point, the next stage that Phil talks about, it's also in the scriptures and things like this, is to become a friend of God. You know, you're a disciple, you've mastered the things that you know, kind of lead you to become a lot like God. And pretty soon you can be a friend. You can have this easy interaction with each other because you recognize that you've, you know, kind of gone through the same wars together, and you've you know, here you are more at the peer level. And then finally there's this nice stage of the bridegroom, the beloved, as this final stage of, you know, guess what? You're in a co-equal relationship with God, where you're the bridegroom to his or you're the bride to his bridegroom, all that wonderful metaphor. So there's these wonderful things within our gospel, within wider spirituality or something, that just talk about exactly what Mary Beth said of, you know. And I've done a download or two on Messiah 3:19, where, you know, it's like natural man is enemy to God and will be unless you put off the natural man and become as a child, willing to submit to all things that the Father sees fit to inflict upon you, just the way a child does to his father. I'll tell you, when we start getting to stage 5 and 6 here, that will come alive for us. And I just, it's the same childhood that is the pre-war, the pre-transition. It's becoming like a child as an adult is a completely different thing, right, Mary Beth? It's a total change in power dynamic.
Yeah, it is. It occurs to me that one way to create a motivational base in addition to the map for this is that in Mormon theology and practice, we're often exhorted to become more Christ-like. Well, if you ask people what the characteristics of Christ are, they will give you, just informally, a map of what an adult of God looks like. And so there's a motivational base to say, oh, I can go through these stages for people who still want to really retain a connection to the church or feel faithful within the church. It creates a framework where you can do that. Many people who read some of those middle stages or adolescent stages of God, they will then feel like, well, there's no meaning to it, or I'm disaffected, or there's whatever. And so there's a way, I think, to go within the framework, not just feel like I'm disaffected.
And one last thing before we leave it. Fowler has a book called Becoming Adult, Becoming Christian. And then the subtitle is Adult Development and Christian Faith. And it was a wonderful thing. And one of the layers that he introduces there is sort of as you get into your confidence with God within your relationship of a connection with the divine, you'll often find in any kind of does a lot of things with your vocation. It's not what you do for a living, but it's what you love to do, what it seems like your life has called you to. And it's a really a wonderful thing. But it's just fun that you had mentioned he wants spiritual adults, and you tied it to Christ-like, and that's one of Fowler's books. So,
anyway. Major, yeah, right.
Sorry, Katie. We've gone. We're taking over.
I love it. No, let's take the opportunity right now to maybe dive into the model just a little bit. I know that Dan, you want to take the lead here, and you know, we mentioned earlier. You know, Mary Beth was saying we're kind of talking about this shared reference that we have, but maybe let's map it out and give the framework as best we can right now, and to kind of give that sort of overall view so that people can orient themselves in the discussion.
Great. Thanks. Yeah. Let me do some things, and Mary Beth, jump in with stuff that I missed out that you sense I'm going past. So,
okay. Great.
So I quickly mentioned that Fowler's project, the book came out in 1981. So it's been out for a long, long time now. But he and his grad students that he'd gathered together or something, I interviewed 359 people, ages, I think 2 or 3 years old, basically as soon as you can be verbal. And I think his oldest person was in their 90s or something that they interviewed. They basically asked people to do a life review, the facts of their birth, their family, turning points in their life, the assessment of their trajectory of life, what gives their life meaning or makes it worth living. And then they really were concentrating on present experience. What are your life-shaping experiences and relationships right now? What are your present values and your commitments? And here's what's so interesting, and what is your religion, if any? Because one of the things I want to kind of say ahead of time is, and a lot of people always ask me, well, is this a stage five way of, what is a stage five belief or something? What Fowler is saying, and Mary Beth kind of gave us a hint here, is this is not about beliefs. So whether you're religious or not, Fowler claims that this is human development, that you sort of live and you orient into centers of meaning and value in different ways. It's like your stance towards life rather than the content of your beliefs. And so if anybody hasn't listened to the last podcast that we did called Life Living Stories with Adam Miller and Stephen Carter, please go there. That was an important one. And in fact, I knew this Fowler one was coming up, and I think in some ways it prompted me having that discussion there, because it's the same sort of thing. It's not about the content of your beliefs. It's not about the actual stories you tell. It's kind of like, how do you live inside your stories? How do you orient towards the different things? So Fowler had these interviews, and then they took all the data after the transcription and things, and they began to map, and they sort of landed with, oh, there's four different areas in which we can kind of see that these are like anchor points that kind of become key pieces of the stages. And those are, how does this person make moral judgments? What's better, worse, right or wrong, good or bad? Their social awareness. So in other words, do they see themselves as primarily part of a group, or do they see their location within their group as, you know, this is just one of many other groups, and there are other, you know, and are you attracted to other groups or just your own or things like that? So your own awareness of yourself in relationship to others. A key one that we'll talk about is locus of authority. Where does the authority rest with this person? Are they primarily looking at other people for signals and clues to what's right, what's wrong, what's true, what's false? Or have they kind of started to own that for themselves? And then the last one, and it's quite an interesting one, is symbolic function. How do symbols function in this person's life? Do they seem like they're literal? If you have a description of God, is that really capture God in this person's mind, or do they have a sense of symbols as multivalent or pointing towards things? In other words, is the symbol kind of detached or jiggered free from the thing that it's pointing to? And so how tightly they hold those. So that's basically how they ended up coming up with a lot of the structure for the stages, was just noticing that people would talk about things in different ways. So any questions or anything you'd like to add more about what Fowler was up to, Mary Beth or Katie?
Fowler was also really, colleagues and really knew other developmental theorists, such as Erik Erikson and Lawrence Kohlberg, even he gives a
Piaget, yep.
piece of it. But he also studied all of those. And so when he mapped out his model, he was using Piaget in cognitive development, Kohlberg in moral development. He was looking at, are there other frameworks where it matches my framework? And Ken Wilber also mentions this, that if you look cross-culturally, many developmental models, very spiritual models, there's this underlying infrastructure that just happens in our cognitive, emotional, social, moral, spiritual development that is all the same across all cultures and all religions. It's named very differently from theorist to religion to, you know, individual student or philosopher, but it's all similar, and he's kind of tapping into that large structure and illuminating it within spiritual belief. So he wasn't kind of a pioneer in the sense that he discovered something new and just created it. He was coming from a framework that then he was adding to.
Yeah, and it's interesting. One of the kind of odd but fun in sort of a weird way parts of the book is he has an imaginary discussion with Piaget, Eric Erickson, Lawrence Kohlberg, you know, where he just kind of gets them in the room in his imagination, and each one kind of bounces off each other, and they kind of talk about how they're all, you know, coming at the same basic stuff, but with their different emphases, like you were talking about there. So I just say, don't get bogged down in that if you're encountering the book for the first time, but after you kind of got a feel for it, it is a fun little discussion to read, a little 15 pages or 20 pages of his book. This imaginary discussion. So, yeah.
Let me just make a quick plug here for a really hard to find book. And there's a woman named Jenny Wade.
Yes, Changes of Mind.
Who does Changes of Mind, and she does a better job of going into the depth of each stage than any other theorist. It's a book that's really her doctoral dissertation. But if you can wrestle your way through it, you can come back to Fowler and more deeply enriched and how it makes sense in your life.
And she really maps the what's happening in your brain, the neurological development, the different structures, what regions of your brain are kind of waking up at different stages of life and things like that too.
Yeah.
So that's the dimension she adds. But I agree. It is a hard book to find, and I lent mine out, and I've looked for it off and on the last few years. I mean, I haven't gone to go buy it, but I'm kind of like, I wonder what friend I lent that to. I'm pissed.
No, you can get it on Amazon.
That's right.
Give it back to Dan.
You can get it online. You can find it easily.
But anyway, I just is one of those. I know I own that book because I really used that book a lot at one point. So you might have turned me on to that, Mary Beth. That was interesting. And then one other thing, too, is Fowler here is going to end up with 6 stages of development. Ken Wilber ended up with 9. Jenny did some interesting things where I think she ends up with 6, but she kind of thinks men and women, it's helpful to have them go off in 2 different directions at certain points, right?
So really, she kinda, just one stage.
Oh, just one just, stage where men and women kind of orient differently usually, right?
On Fowler's stage 4, the individuative reflexive stage, she says that men move more towards an achievement focus and women move towards an affiliative focus.
Right.
But then they come back again, and so there's
right.
still gender differences,
yeah,
of course,
yeah.
but that isn't fleshed out much except for at that stage for Wade.
So yeah, like we were saying, this is just maps. It's not, it isn't the territory, but it's helpful, and when you locate yourself within it, and kind of trust that perhaps even if you're not at a stage that maybe is, you know, let's say you find yourself mostly in a stage 4, if you can imagine that 5 or 6 might be out there, and if they can feel at all attractive to you, you know, there's sort of a prescriptive element to it as well as a descriptive. I mean, he's trying to be descriptive, but there's sort of a sense of hope and whatnot that I think can come from it. But don't think that anybody thinks that this captures the entire, you know, reality of it.
No, it doesn't. And I want to hop into, before you go into the stages, I want to address an important question. There's been a big debate about these stage models. Are they higher and lower than others?
Right, right.
Or if things are all equal in importance, how do you make sense of that? So I have Ken Wilber solves that problem in what he calls something is not hierarchical or not something is, you know, egalitarian or equal. He calls it holarchical, H-O-L-A-R-C-H-A-L, holarchical. Anyway, I misspelled it. The point is that the two are integrated. The perpendicular and the horizontal are integrated, and by calling it holarchical. So here's my image of it that makes sense, and that might then help when you're going through the stages. Do you remember those cups when you went to camp on it was flat, and it had all these little circles in it, and then when you pulled it up, it created a cup, and you could then drink from the cup. So imagine when we're born as infants that we're born in this little flat cup. All we have in terms of consciousness, or even one or two, is the center of the cup, the little smallest hole. But each stage we grow, we get more depth and breadth. So let's pull it up from the bottom. In the next second stage, you have a lot more depth, and you have a lot more breadth at the same time. So as you go through each stage, you just keep unfolding each circle, getting more depth and breadth at the same time, even though it's a little chaotic at times. And that seems to me like a good integration of that problem.
Yes, I've loved your collapsible drinking cup thing, and I definitely remember those from my camping days. And I do that because everything transcends, but it includes. And so the gifts, he's very careful. Each stage has gifts that stay with you. You know, but you can also kind of get stuck because certain gifts become very, very powerful, and or you just don't quite complete the full moves, or I don't know. But that'll make more sense as we go. But yeah, I love the collapsible drinking cup there.
That was great. Yeah, I'd never heard that before. That was awesome. Very, very useful. Okay, Dan, why don't we dive in? Why don't you take us through the stages? Fowler's six stages.
Yeah, I'll do my best here. The first one, he actually is a pre-stage. He just calls it, it's birth to age 6 months, because we don't really know what's going on inside an infant's, you know, head at that thing. But it's very, very important. And it's also helpful to talk about this, because, again, it helps us set up that we're not talking about beliefs here. We're talking about a sense of things, how life feels and how you sort of orient to it. And so he kind of imagines that in that first 6 months, the things that are very important to have happen, or the things that do happen that kind of set a stage for much of the rest of your life, he calls it an undifferentiated thing. But it's that sense when you're an infant of, does it feel like my presence in this universe is welcome? When I cry out, does somebody come and immediately attend to me? Are my needs being met? Am I being stimulated? Does this life seem interesting or whatnot? And so we know about the kids, and Mary Beth, maybe you've even had people with attachment disorders or whatnot, but you know, some of these kids that are in these massive orphanages who don't get held a lot as a child or something, they seem to, at least it's kind of shown through the anecdotal evidence later, they have trouble forming attachments the rest of their life, right?
Correct. Or if they do, it becomes an unstable, or what is called insecure attachment. So it waffles back and forth between come closer, stay farther away.
Right. And if you're not stimulated a lot, maybe some of those neural, I think everyone kind of has a sense that your brain is just always making connections between neurons. And without the stimulation, some of those pathways are not really at this time when your brain should just be, you know, taking in the world and having new pathways forming your life. Without stimulation, that can be kind of a thing that's harmful for you later. So this first 6 months of life is so important about whether or not you kind of feel like the universe is on your side or not, even if you can't have any sense of a difference between yourself and others. You know, when an infant's probably, you know, 3, 4, 5 months old, they probably don't really, they're not able to say, mommy's here or mommy's not here. It's more that level of, I don't know.
Is it that level? Yes. Well, it doesn't just require deprivation. Autism, people on the autism spectrum also have difficulty, even if they have a lot of stimulation. So there's neurological background to a lot of what we're talking about.
Yeah. So anyway, but that, it's just an important thing. But again, I wanted to emphasize there's no cognitive thought going on here in terms of being able to, you know, self-consciousness, self-awareness, any of that what do I believe stuff. It's just that felt level, and that's kind of helpful just to remember as we go through the rest of this, that it's not about the content of the belief, but sort of the orienting towards different things. So basically, as language begins to emerge, that's when the beginning of thoughts can happen. You get sort of play becomes very, very important. And so the next stage is he calls it intuitive projective, and this is what he actually calls stage one, and it's basically ages 0 to 6 years old. And this is the emergence of self-awareness, but yet you're not really at this stage really all that aware that you're all that different from others. You know, I might be a separate person from you, but you have that sense of everybody would think just like me, kind of thing or whatnot. You don't really notice two differences.
Or if you see somebody different, it's black and white in terms of good and bad.
Right,
it's much like learning a language. You learn this little piece there and you learn that piece there, but you haven't linked it all together as a whole ability to express. So it's kind of hopscotch.
Nice. So the imagination begins to take place here, and if you have more things to draw on, all the better for stimulating. So it's important for us to have story time with our kids and to expose them to different things and stuff, because these are things that they are basically constructing a worldview out of eventually, is all the different kinds of things you give them. And so better, richer stories really can have an impact, even though they don't put them together in kind of a coherent whole until a little bit later on here. So bits and pieces of info strung together. No worry if it's logical. Some of my favorite parts of the book are when he interviews the kids and you'll tell them they'll be sure theory about this is the way the world works, and the questioner will ask them something else and they'll tell something. They'll just make it up on the spot, drawing. You can tell that they're drawing on different things, but there's no sense in the kid that he or she is telling you stuff that just don't fit together whatsoever, kind of thing. So there's just no integration of logic or whatnot at this age. You ask them a question and they'll have a rich set of resources to draw on. They'll combine and recombine without any awareness. This is one of the problems that can happen here, though. This is where the sense of a taboo can kind of begin to take place. And I think, we all, that's kind of a weird word, and we all kind of think taboo, ooh, scary, right? That's kind of the initial thing. This is a taboo. And so it's important in some ways to sort of say and to communicate to a child, this is an area where you have to be really careful or something like that. But one of the dangers of age six or, in these first few years or something, is you can really, if a child senses taboo at too deep a level, especially perhaps around their own body, sexuality, or something like that, it can really be a negative mark that probably Mary Beth and you, Katie, as you go into your therapy career, you guys deal with that a lot, wouldn't you say?
Yes, and a lot of what's happened with people at maybe a later stage, but they get caught or they have whatever. What happens is they're still a part of the self that is still back in that stage.
Right.
It needs to be gone back. It's called, in one therapy place, it's called regression in service of the ego. You're going back and kind of clean that out or bring it up to date so that, in fact, you can, the rest of the self can develop and that part of the self can develop also.
Yes. And so there's rich gift of imagination, strong sense that some things are powerful and valuable, but it's not at this really processed level. And taboo can be helpful, but it also can be there. And, the danger of it is if they get possessed by images of terror or destructiveness. I think that's his language there, that, that's one thing to watch out for.
In terms of therapy processes, there's an easy way to get what that means, and that is there's a lot of use of guided imagery for people who, whether there's a guided meditation or whether guided imagery in terms of helping us to feel and in our imagination experience, not just going back into that stage, but then growing beyond it. So that's just a little, and there are many, many guided imagery apps that people can download and find if, in fact, you want to kind of play with that yourself.
Oh, fun. Good. Well, thanks. From ages 7 to 12 is where he's drawn, these arbitrary lines. It's not hard and fast. But his stage 2 he calls mythic literal. And those terms, we'll kind of unpack them as we go here. Basically, as I was talking about these kids that will tell you something, they've got it figured out because you've prompted their thought and they've made up, you know, this is the way it is and that's the way it is and stuff like this. They now begin to sort of develop a more orderly story. There's more logic to it. They begin to kind of put together a story of stories. Do you see what I'm saying? You know, instead of separate stories, now they're kind of able to string it, and they kind of think of things in the past, they think of things in the present, they start imagining things in the future. His language is a construction of more orderly, temporally linear, and a dependable world. And this, if you think about your 7 to 12-year-old things, this is also where it's so important. Is this real or is this make-believe? Right? So that's a very, very important thing that starts to happen. Those are the kinds of questions that you ask much earlier than these age. You start asking for proof or demonstration of fact. I can't remember if it's in the book itself. You know, this is the level where the empiricist is born. You know, the one
that
says,
"Yeah,
exactly. You want to show this to me." Another thing, the imagination is still rampant, but it's a sense that it's still a free world of play. There's not a whole lot of consequences that come to you when you're off here. So it's kind of neat and healthy that you're going long, you know, you're starting to get this story of stories, but you're not really, because it'll be interesting when we talk about stage three, you're not super, super conscious of other people looking at you all that much. And, you know, there's not that many consequences if you kind of are weird, you know.
Well, no, actually, you know,
okay, so fix me there.
Okay, I would disagree with you, which is that there are many consequences if you're in a culture or a family where there's sort of rigid right and wrong, so that if you're on the wrong side of something, there are a lot of consequences. And it's in this stage, keep in mind, within Mormon world, you're being baptized in this at stage eight. And you're getting a lot of training in what's right and wrong. Now, in terms of the imagination and allowing that for free play within the self, like in books or whatever, then, you know, that can happen more. But sometimes it stops happening in the outer world because you learn clear codes of moral conduct, and social rules. And there's a high emphasis on fairness. That's fair, that's not fair. Think of elementary school kids. That's where we are here. And so there are actually a lot of consequences, but in fact, the imaginative and the ordering of the world goes on inside, and many people will describe a real richness about that. Now, I think there's also a gender difference, although Annette Fowler does not mention it, because girls will be highly attuned to the social rules and the social interaction and how and where they are, not just in terms of like, am I okay, in terms of girl cliques, but it's also in terms of how do I care for other people? So Gilligan talks about this much more than Kohlberg does, for instance. And so there's this care, there's this developmental model of how one cares that's going alongside, that's really dominant for girls.
Yeah, absolutely. Good. And I was just in my brain, I was just more focusing on the free world of play and association of ideas and all that. But you're right. Absolutely. You're picking up these codes and these strong senses of things throughout this. So there are consequences when your inner beats the outer world for sure there. So that's awesome. Now, one of the things that also really emerges here is that sense of moral rules and attitudes. So fairness, reciprocity, this is right, this is wrong. You know, if you look at your 10, 12-year-old, this is the moral cops of your house, of your family or something like that. And this is where you get, you know, there's no sense of that their inner life and their sense of what's right or what's wrong wouldn't be relativized in somebody else who came from a different things. And so as you're walking into the grocery store or whatever, and there's a person doing their 25 feet out smoking a cigarette, you're just cringing that your 9-year-old isn't going to say, "Mom, that dad, that guy's bad because he's smoking." You know, right? You just, because there's no sense of other people having an internal life there. It's just right or wrong, left or, and so you do that sort of thing. And then also one of the things that's here, and this is why the mythic literal, This is where the first time he really begins to talk about symbols. Fowler starts to talk about symbols. And this is that symbols are one-dimensional and literal. They're not really symbols. There's no sense of it being a symbol. And so I know I bring this one up a lot. I did it in the one with John. But the one that seems the easiest for me to illustrate this is the flag is sacred. You know, you're in school. You're pledging allegiance to the flag. The flag's up there. You have a sense that what's wrong, Katie? If that flag touches the floor, what do you need to do?
Burn it.
Because that is desecrated. There's something, you know, in that symbol that we all recognize. The flag is a symbol that's, you know, stands for so much and freedom and da-da-da-da-da. For the person, it's literally sacred stuff. And, you know, you get this with Mormon garments. Oh, don't put them on the floor. So the flag is sacred, must be burned. Later, you begin to be able to differentiate that. And if I remember right, Mary Beth from Jenny Wade's book, she kind of talks about, you know, it's almost impossible for somebody who's up into before adolescence to begin to separate this, because she's talking about brain development. I believe it's the corpus callosum, which is kind of the center of your brain that sort of lets right brain and left brain communicate across the hemispheres. That's really only starting to come to focus here. It's been too long since I've read it. Is that the case, that it's really starting to form, so that kind of the holistic side of the brain, you know, not that, you know, obviously you can, the brain can learn all the different functions, but there's sort of a sense of a holistic side and a linear side. And so until the two can talk about it, it's hard to kind of separate a symbol from the thing it might be pointing to.
Okay, so Jenny Wade, in terms of her brain functions, I just looked it up. It's what's dominant here is the limbic system. Now, keep in mind that you still have the corpus callosum and the, you know, the reptilian brain, as it were. It's always still active. You're just adding on, and so now you have more capacity, but you don't, much like when you learn to walk, you can still crawl. And so let me introduce a little concept here as we go along that will help one say, oh, what's active in this, what's active in that. We still have access to all the previous stages. So my very favorite birthday card says this: we are all always all of the ages we have ever been.
Nice.
So it's that unfolding cup. You know, you can still have access to the water on the bottom of it as well as the top.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, anyway, so by the time you're 12, 13, you're basically able to move on to the next stage. But there's just, let me just kind of do the pros and the cons of stage two, the gifts and as well as the warnings. Towards the end of each stage, you know, Fowler kind of summarizes each one. So the great ability to narrate one's own experience, to bind it together through stories. But here's the key: at this mythic literal stage, they never step out of the flow of their own story to reflect on the fact that it is a story. So it's one story among other stories. That's what we're going to begin to get here as we move ahead. Now he says the danger of the mythic literal stage can be severe literalness, perfectionism, or a sense of works righteousness. And the failures that can come when that's what you have picked up can start to stick and tell the person that they are bad, wrong, or damaged. So that's right. That's kind of the stuff that you just have to do. So this is one of those areas, like you're talking about, you might need some regression therapy or something in service of the ego, Mary Beth, here, for people just to who've been somehow at that stage that didn't make a healthy transition into the next one.
They didn't make the transition. And so just even in everyday life, if you see somebody, an adult, then talk briefly about all of that, whatever, you say, oh, a part of themself is still active at that stage, right? And they've integrated in some way that doesn't make sense to me, but it makes sense to them.
Yeah.
So people will hop around between stages when they're talking, and people, this is confusing, you said this and blah, blah, blah. If you really look at developmental theory, you're kind of like, well, they're hopping all over the place. There are many stages at once, and the answer is yes.
Yes. Nice. And you're at a, you know, and the thing that we, I almost mentioned this before, so I'll just quickly throw it in there now. When you're under stress, you know, you're going to revert to sort of a centering at an earlier stage of development. And when you're feeling like all is well within the world, that's when you'll have those PEAK experiences, you know, where you can kind of perhaps see a little bit ahead into, you know, the vision of a wholeness or whatnot that's sort of ahead for you. And so it's not only that you live in stages based upon age or chronology, but like if you're under stress right now, guess what? You're probably gonna, the stuff that's, you know, more hardwired and that you'd been there before, that's probably where you're gonna go back a little bit.
Yeah. But,
yeah, so
anyway. Yeah, under stress, we all regress.
Have a little. Oh, I had never heard that. That's awesome.
That's very lovely.
Very cool. Very cool. Anyway, well, so now we're going to get to the adult stages. So this is the very most interesting thing. And so, Katie, anything in these, you know, pre-stage and stages 1 and 2 that you want to jump in? You know, here, I'm playing the host here by making sure all the guests get to speak up for yourself. I just want you to always feel free to jump in. Do you have anything at this point?
No, I've been very enlightened by your insights, though, so thank you.
Okay. Well, do jump in, and you truly are the host, so tell me to be quiet.
Be quiet, Dan.
Okay.
Now speak, Dan. Now it's your turn again.
All right. Beginning about age 13, and Fowler basically talks about stage 3. He calls it the synthetic conventional phase, stage, and we're going to talk about the word synthetic coming from synthesis and whatnot, and conventional meaning not necessarily out of the box, you know, conventional thinking, that's a conventional attitude or something like that. We got to think of it as sort of like, you know, within the group or kind of the acceptable here. So synthetic conventional faith, basically he says, starting about age 13 and through the end of people's lives, many people will center at what we're about to describe. And again, Mary Beth, you kind of hinted at it before. Go find these stages, be looking at a map or something, right? Because
yes,
they're not going to make that much sense.
That's right. Otherwise we're talking about traveling in a foreign country and you don't have a map to look at, so you don't know what's being talked about.
Yeah, so go somewhere so you can at least see the names of these things and pause the podcast and look. But synthetic conventional phase is lots of things. At the end, he's got lots of appendices of the book. And at one point, I kind of looked at different people at different ages that he, you know, he has the ages and male and female breakdowns and whatnot. And for adults, he ends up with about 40% of the people that they interviewed being either in this stage 3 or stage 3 to 4 transition. So again, you know, it's more likely when you're a young adult that you're in this stage 3, you know, moving into stage 4. But 40% of people, that even, you know, kind of some of the older people, he had quite a bit here. So at any one time, you might be able to say, you know, just expect that there's lots of people that this is sort of where they landed and didn't have triggers in their life or something that would move them on. But anyway, so stage 3, synthetic conventional. Here is where he begins to talk about mutual perspective taking. The phrase that he uses is here, you know, and this is obviously where peer pressure, you know, really becomes more intense in your teenage years, right? I see you seeing me. I see the me I think you see. And so there's this phrase of, oh, I'm not just in my own world. I'm not this, you know, there's people are noticing me. People are watching me and I sort of change my life around to present a good, what seems to me will be the pathway to security and happiness and whatnot. So this peer pressure, often he calls it the tyranny of the they. So the tyrant becomes the they. There's this group of people and how I look to them is very, very important. And so this is the kind of stuff that can really begin to happen at this age, or I'm sure it happens a little bit earlier, but this is kind of there. So this awareness of beyond family and people like us. So as we kind of mentioned there with the smoking example of the kid in the literal mythic stage, there's no sense of an internal life of others where they might have chosen differently than you, or they might have a different value system than you. In this stage, you're finally able to begin to say, oh, not everybody thinks like me, not everybody thinks like my family, but, you know, of course, our way of thinking is right. You know, this is where happiness is. This is where I want to be, is in this conventional, you know, thoughts that I've gotten the messages from others, so I know this, but there's at least that sense that begins to emerge. So with this, there's a new burden, some of his language is there's a new burden of self-consciousness, mutual interpersonal perspective taking, more awareness of the expectations that are on us. We move from rules and laws to people and relationships, the peers, the media, pop culture, religious institutions. Our tacit values, or we have these values, but we hold them tacitly, meaning unconsciously. We generally have just assumed them. They're not explicit. We haven't examined them as a system. And so there's a philosopher, Santayana, that Fowler uses, and this is an important thing, and I'm sure it's come up a million times, you know, I'm sure this won't be the first exposure to people who've heard it, but there's this phrase that he comes up and he says, you know, we're not sure who developed or who first understood the qualities of water, but we're pretty sure it's not the fish.
Right.
When you're swimming in a story, when you're swimming in the water, it's just your environment. This is just the world as presented to you, and you don't have that, or you haven't taken that chance to really begin to step outside of it and say, oh, this is my environment, and it's not everybody else's environment. You know, that thing. And so you don't really examine yours as one system among others. Now, here's where the authority and the locus of authority stuff begins between stages 3 and stage 4. This is where this becomes very, very important. We generally, beginning at this stage, and often you'll notice it throughout life, we look to others to give us the authoritative pronouncements on everything from, you know, obviously what to believe. We're kind of talking in religion here, things, but how to dress, you know, what's a value, where the action is. We basically are looking to other people to kind of tell us and give us the signals for how to negotiate our way through life at basically every level. We trust the authority figures and we value the face-to-face group that we're in more than ourself and our ability to discover things on our own. And it's natural and it's healthy, and of course this is, you got to be stable. You said something about Mary Beth about the importance of stabilizing within sort of each part of the collapsible drinking cup, right, before you're able to move on.
That's right. You go through the disruption of entering the new stage. Takes a year, sometimes years, to work that out, but then you need to stabilize there, get all the gifts of that stage. It helps if you know future stages are coming, but to stabilize with that and use all the gifts and enjoy them, because they're amazing gifts in each one. That it's much like you're developing a toolkit, so you might as well keep every tool as you move on to more complex tools, but you can really enjoy it. So one developmental person that I've talked with a lot, a guy named John Kessler, who's worked a lot with Wilbur and spiritual stuff, says that really to be quite alive, you need to go back and visit every stage every day in some way.
Mm.
So you pick it up purposely to go back into some magic and enjoy it, or you purposely pick up, like, you know, and enjoy the gifts of it.
Nice, nice. Yeah. And, you know, one of the gifts to me of this stage, and so, you know, we're, you know, a lot of people who are in faith transition or, you know, kind of moving, you know, in this stage 4 area, they'll look back at stage 3 and kind of bemoan the, oh, I used to think that. I used to be that narrow. I used to, you know, whatever it is, the world was that black and white to me. And they kind of just like, they hate that that was part of, you know, their history, and just wish that they were this greater enlightened being at all points. And yet, we forget that there were great gifts to that. And one of the things is, and it's ideal when you have a sense of stability, because now I have a home base in which I can travel and I can put my feelers out and I can do some exploring, but I kind of always know where home is. You know, mm-hmm. I kind of have that stable center that I'm, you know, it's holding me in orbit while I do some other things. Now, eventually, other centers of gravity will happen within you, and you might be able to transition. And obviously, the next transition is to get this authority more within yourself rather than the group and what they say, and, you know, sacred texts and sacred scriptures, and find out what it is that matches your own experience and your own way of weighing things. But it's important that, you know, we do these things. And so when somebody, you know, who's in a progressive sort of, you know, I'm moving beyond the literal self, and they want to rob their children a little bit of, you know, it's okay in primary if you're singing these songs. It's okay if you're doing that, if they kind of hold it at a literal stage, because know that at the time, when the time is right, you'll have those conversations and you'll start to clue them in on the much more nuanced way that you view the world now. But it's important for them to kind of feel stable there, right?
Right. An analogy is to an artist learning art is really important, even if you want to become an abstract or an impressionistic person, that you learn the real rules of drawing, a perspective of, you know, eye hand coordinate. You really learn the method, or you learn another language. You actually follow the rules of that language. Later on, you can flex it. But at the beginning, at this stage of learning, you don't. It works better if you adhere to it.
Yes. Absolutely. So home base and stage three is great. Now, again, we call it synthetic and conventional synthesis, coming from the idea of multiple things coming together. And this is where he begins to say you finally have the ability to attain what you'd call a worldview. And, you know, a worldview is far more than just your beliefs. I mean, they're certainly a part of it, but it's again, what's the most meaningful? What's the purpose of life? The big questions. How do I move through the world successfully? You begin to sense of who are my models? Who are my teachers? Who are those that I want to pattern myself at? And so it's just this felt kind of view that you inhabit things and you kind of act and you experience out of. So that's one of the things here. And then conventional, I mentioned, you know, Fowler, I think, uses the term at one point. It's almost like a conformist stage in the sense that you're really attuned to the expectations and judgments of the significant others in your life, your parents, your friends, perhaps religious leaders, things like this. If you've internalized an idea of God, you're very attuned to expectations and judgments. You know, you're not sure enough of the grasp on your own identity, your own autonomous judgment to create or maintain kind of, you know, independent perspectives from them. And so that's a big thing. And then let's talk about symbols again. So we talked about before how the symbol and what it signified isn't really able to be separated. Here we begin to do that. You know, you could talk with most people in the world and kind of say, you know, that flag is, it's not the molecules, it's not the cloth itself that's sacred, it's the ideas that it represents. And you can have moral outrage over the flag being burnt, you know, in protest or something like this, or somebody's wearing it for just a pair of jeans and whatnot, but you're not getting the sense that it's a desecration of, you know, something that literally, you know, is, you know, vibrating at a different level, you know,
right,
than anything else. So Fowler's language for symbols at this change is, though we're able to kind of separate them a little bit, he still says that people at this stage often kind of quote unquote dwell in their symbols. They don't fully symbolize or separate them from what they symbolize. So there you might get a sense of something being a worthy symbol, an important symbol, something that really is there, and there is a sacredness to it. They're sort of brimming with light or something, you know, at a stronger degree than perhaps later when you might just the next stage. In fact, we'll talk about this a lot. But things like this is where you get the ideas of, yeah, I know that the name of God doesn't capture God, but I still don't want to take God's name in vain. Right? Yeah, that
correct.
Kind of thing.
Correct.
Or, you know.
Right. I still want to honor the sacred, even though I don't see this, you know, in the molecules, whatever, but I'm honoring that to respect
yeah.
for it.
So that would be kind of the interpretation there. So authority and symbol and location of social awareness, those are the key things that have, you know, really started to come alive for us. And, of course, stage four is the one where people will all of a sudden say, holy smokes, I have, everything's changing for me. This is a upside down thing. I almost mentioned earlier on, you guys, Katie, you used the term faith transition, and that's kind of what I've been using lately too. And I think it's becoming more popular than faith crisis. But we do need
right.
to honor the fact that for many people, it feels like a crisis.
It's a big crisis. Yeah, this is the adolescent of God.
Yes.
Stage.
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
And everything
right.
is in turmoil when you're an adolescent, right? It's topsy turvy.
Right.
I one of the people when I so when I had the Fowler encounter and I read Faithful Change and then I read Stages of Faith, that's where I discovered independently of you, Mary Beth, Ken Wilber. I discovered, you know, Jenny Wade, I think maybe through you, through the Sunstone piece that you wrote. But I got into Stanislav and Christina Grof. I don't know if you guys know them.
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, one of their books that was so important for me was Spiritual Emergency, When Personal Transformation Becomes a Crisis. You know, and so they've got a bunch of essays in here of people that are talking about this. And so faith, whether we think of it in faith transition, I like that language because, again, it does sort of normalize it. Hey, it's normal that everybody goes through transitions in life, but the feeling can be crisis. And so let's just dive in a little bit. Actually, let's just take a break here and call this the end of part one of this discussion, and we'll begin part two with stage four.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well. All is well. All is well.